All right. So my name is Zori May, and I'm at Guile Hall on the campus of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I'm doing a Their Story interview with Professor Wallace Ford, who is currently in Harlem, New York. Today is October 28th, 2022, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hi, Professor Ford. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a real pleasure. It's a real pleasure. You know, it has been, oh my Lord, you know, 52 years since I graduated from the college, and you, and I can only hope for you that you'll have a similar experience. You say, well, I hope people remember what the hell we were doing back there, because we were doing some real things. And so it's good to be remembered while we're still above ground. So that's great.
Awesome.
Which I plan to stay above ground for quite a while. So that's
right. We sure hope so. First, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your childhood. So if you could please state when and where you were born.
Sure. Only reason I'm laughing because it's kind of a, you know, if for people who play pool, it's kind of like a three cushion, four cushion shot, how things happen. I live in Harlem, as you said, on 135th Street. I was born on 122nd Street. I was born in January of 1950. As January 13th, which happened to be a Friday. And we won't talk about what that may or may not mean, but, and my first couple of years, you know, my parents lived in Harlem, as a son of Wallace Ford and Carmen Ford. And, both of whom came from not fancy backgrounds, to say the least. My paternal grandparents, one was a longshoreman, and my grandmother, my father's side, was a domestic, you know, cleaning, you know, maid in people's homes. My maternal grandfather was a Pullman car porter, which was one of the jobs that brothers had in those days, you know, riding all over the country and, you know, carrying people's bags and what have you. And then my maternal grandmother, who was from Puerto Rico, as a matter of fact, she was a seamstress her whole life. And my father, when he came out of the military, he did go to college and got a degree in accounting. And my mother, who spent the last few years in high school at a convent out on Staten Island because of some family issues, graduated, I think, like 17 years old. But there were no opportunities to go to college for a young black girl. You know, there was no programs. There was nothing. You know? And so she went to work. She started working at the age of 17 as a bookkeeper, which is basically what she did for the rest of her life. So my father was an accountant and my mother was a bookkeeper, and I'm living proof that math proficiency does not transfer genetically. So as I said, lived in Harlem and as a little kid, and my father, after graduating with a, you know, as an accountant with a degree, looked to get a job with an accounting firm in New York City. No accounting firm in New York City would hire him. As a black man, right? So my father had been in World War II as in the military, and he, you know, so that he knew that. And so that was the one institution he went to. And then remember, this is like 1952, 53. And so we're still in a post-war era, what have you. Long story short, my father went to the Department of the Army as a civilian, and they gave him a job. And the job was to work as an accountant in Japan, because the U.S. had like 350,000, 400,000 troops still occupying Japan. And so where you have that level of occupation, obviously my father's not going there in a military context, but there's an audit function, right? There's all this money going around and what have you. And so there's an audit function. So he went there. So my father goes to Japan. And had to leave his wife and little kid behind because they assigned him to a part of Japan where, you know, you can bring families, Hokkaido, which is the Alaska of Japan. And so it wasn't until 1950. Remember, there was no internet. There's no long distance calls. There's none of that stuff. And, you know, how a young couple was able to kind of like maintain in those days is kind of a lesson for us all, in that you think you have challenges, right? Or I think I have challenges. Yeah, there's, and then there's challenges. And again, After he kind of proved himself, they transferred him to, you know, major cities in the South where there are military bases, and we were able to join him. And so I took my first airplane trip at the age of four, and with my mother, and we flew to Seattle. And my mother tells me the story that, you know, that, well, those are the days when you got on the airplane, you dressed up, you wore a suit, tie, and all that kind of stuff. I had a little suit and tie, and I also had a medical bag because I would be a doctor. And so when I went on the plane, I said to the stewardess, my name is Dr. Ford, and if anybody gets sick, you just call me. I have to laugh myself. I said, what is, get out of here, kid. And of course, I slept the whole way. And then we took a ship from Seattle to, I believe, Fukuoka in Japan, which is where I got to see my dad after, you know, close to a year. And I remember our meeting, and I, you know, just 4 years old, barely had an image of him on, but as soon as I saw him, I knew who that was and ran and jumped in his arms, and we were good. So that's the first place I went to school, was in Japan. So, and I'll have to send you some photos, Azuri, because I went to a Japanese kindergarten. So you see, you know, Japanese kids wear those little uniforms. There was me. You'll be able to find me in the picture. You know? I went to Japanese kindergarten, but I was taught in English, and which is where I learned to read. And I learned, you know, I was very fortunate in that, you know, we're all blessed with different skills. I never mastered the crossover dribble or a dunk, but I learned to read immediately. As soon as I knew my alphabet, and as soon as I figured see Jack run, literally see Jack run, see Mary run, it all just kind of fell into place. And so I never learned to read, I tell people. And when I worked as a student teacher with the Dartmouth program in Jersey City years later, obviously assistant teachers, they asked me to help a young man learn to, you know, with his reading. And I really couldn't help him because I didn't learn to read. So it's hard to teach somebody how to learn to read. And, you know, it's just like, you just do this, you know. Mm-hmm. But back to it. So I went to Japanese kindergarten, and then I went to a English Catholic school. The Europeans had quite a presence in Japan before the war. And there's still, you know, Marist Brothers High School, it was called. And I went there in the first grade at the age of five. And I call this part, Zori, part of the law of unintended consequences. Because what happened? Because my father faced all this discrimination, racism in the U.S., he had to go to Japan to find a job. And, of course, he had to bring his wife and son. His son gets to go to school and be in the first grade at the age of five, which is, I was in the New York City public school system, just doesn't happen. I don't care how bright you are. Okay. And then it gets really interesting. I spent about a week in the first grade, and they put me in the second grade, you know, and they put me in the second grade because I said, you know, this is ridiculous. We just need to put you in the second grade. You know, you're not benefiting from the first grade. And I remember going home and telling my parents I'm in the second grade. And I said, what did we tell you about lying? You know, and I said, no, no, really. Look, I have new books. And I had to go to the school and said, yes, you know. And so as a result, I got really skipped and jumped ahead in the educational process, which would not have happened if I was in New York. You know, just going forward, I was a freshman at 16 at Dartmouth, you know, and so I was the youngest person in my class. I'll always be the youngest person in my class, you know, when we have reunions and what have you. And so, I went to school in a, English Catholic school, and that was fine. Then we moved, and I went to a U.S. school for the first time. I was now, I guess I was still in the second grade, maybe going into third grade. And I'll never forget, and I know we got to get to the Dartmouth part, but you asked. first, have you ever transferred to another school, new school, in the middle of a semester?
Yep.
Okay, so you know they bring you in and say, class, this is Zori, and everybody's looking at you, right? So this is Wallace, and come in and say, come on, all right, I'll sit down. And so then they stand up to sing the national anthem. I belt out, God Save the Queen, you know? And they're like, what is wrong with this kid? Because I went to an English school, right? God save our royal queen. And they, you know, it's like, get out of here. So we got it together. So we left Japan on my seventh birthday, January 13th, 1957. And my father wound up with an assignment in Puerto Rico, still as a civilian in Puerto Rico, which is where I went to school for third grade and fourth grade. By the way, I learned to speak fluent Japanese while I was in Japan. I mean, because we lived in town. We didn't live on any military bases. We lived in town. And I was a family interpreter, a little five-year-old. You know, so, but I, you know, I was fluent Japanese. My mother, who sadly has passed away now, but she would tell me that until I was about 8 or 9 years old, I would speak in my sleep in Japanese. You know, and of course, most men learn to stop speaking in their sleep, period. And so we don't know if I would still speak in Japanese. But it was just that ingrained with me. Sadly, I don't really remember much because I never learned to read. Okay. And that would have made a difference, I think, if I learned to read. Although, we'll fast forward just for a moment. I mean, I was like, oh gosh, I was 40 and I was a New York City commissioner for business for ports of trade. I was asked to head a delegation of New York City officials to meet with our counterparts in the Tokyo metropolitan government. So this is like 33 years later, I go back to Japan. I'm in Tokyo, which we never lived in Tokyo, by the way, but of course had visited. And I've got a quick quiz for you, Zori, which is of the five senses, which one triggers memory the most?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, wow. I want to say sight, but that seems too simple.
That's too wrong, yes. It's olfactory, right? Sense of smell. And so, you know, when you travel, you know, time zones and all that, yeah, you're all disoriented. So we got together finally for breakfast the next day, and they served me a bowl of green tea. And I smelled, and it was like, bang, I was back in Japan. Although again, I couldn't, I had bits and pieces of the language, but I felt culturally comfortable. And on all my, I guess we'll talk about this at a point, on all my international work and international travels and what have you, I firmly believe that it's more important to be culturally comfortable than to know the language. People will work with you on the language, but if you're culturally comfortable, as I say, if you're a knucklehead, you can convey that very clearly that you're a knucklehead. But if you can just go along with different cultures, and so I was good for the week that I was there and even broke away from the folks at one point and just kind of traveled a little bit through Tokyo. And I went to a, obviously a Japanese sushi bar. And so it's like, I don't really speak any Japanese, but I could say, tekamaki dozo. And it's, and so that was pretty cool. But in any event, we were in Puerto Rico. And I didn't learn to speak Spanish in Puerto Rico because most of the time we actually did live on a civilian quarters and military base. And then we came to New York. And so I was about the age of 9 now. So I was in the 5th grade now. And I was in, we lived in New Rochelle for a little while. And then we moved to Teaneck, New Jersey in January of 1959. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that is when, so I was 8 in the 5th grade. Yeah. And so, and fortunately, I was always tall for my age. Okay. Mm-hmm. I wasn't anybody's, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but I was tall for my, so when you walked in the room, you didn't know, oh yeah, this is the kid, right? This is the kid. I kind of kept up and then ultimately was taller than most of my classmates. That's another story. And so so I was in public high school in Teaneck from 5th grade through high school. And we were very fortunate that Teaneck had one of the best public school systems in the country at the time. And so while it wasn't fancy or what have you, we had very enriched programs. And they had something in Teaneck called, and many schools, of course, it's called heterogeneous groupings, right? Where you put the students, you put it bluntly, students who are most advanced or what have you, put them in classes, and then there's the other kids and the rest of it. You probably experienced that yourself. And so... I never asked for that one way or the other, but there I was with them. And my parents, again, you have to remember this is like 1958, 59. They're still hanging brothers and sisters and, slapping people off stools in Woolworths and segregation now, segregation forever. All of this is going on. And my father and mother told me that you are – it's not about being as good as anybody else. You want to be better. It's not even about good. Well, see, as a black person in America, that'll get you in trouble because they call you arrogant, you know. And I always considered it a badge of honor. And I said, and I tell, you know, brothers and sisters, I tell you as well, if nobody's ever called you arrogant, you're not doing your job, you know, because, you know, it's like, it's a, yeah, I'm not worried about being as good as you, you know, I'm not worried about that. I'm clearly better than you, and you just have to live with it. And even if I'm not, I still think I'm better than you, you know. And so, you know, that has kind of plagued me through my life, but it's plagued me. It's gone through with my life, but I'm very comfortable with it. And I have a son who's now 25, and I tell him the same thing, you know, and because, you know, if you believe in white supremacy, then it's true, you know, and I just was never taught to believe in it. And so, of course, that would result in some rather difficult conversations in these schools, but, and particularly at Dartmouth, and we'll get to that in a moment, because it was I'd love to say, who do you think you are? You know, here I am, you know, and you come back tomorrow, I'm still gonna be right here, you know. And that was just in my parents were not civil rights activists in the terms of, you know, they're going out marching, but I always say I'm my parents' contribution to the struggle, right? Because it was the idea that my parents, you know, it was, you know, I was always, fortunately, a very good student, math not included, but it came easily to me. And I never really struggled except in physics in high school, I think. And so that was not the struggle. The struggle was to, you know, not to be good enough, but to be your best. And, you know, heaven, you know, my parents were like, you hear about Asian parents, you come home with a B, you get beaten. You know, I didn't get beaten, but it's like, why is this a B? Why is that a B? You know, and so, and that was good. It was very good. And I responded well to it. Not every child will, but I responded well to it because, you know, I was blessed with those tools and what have you. I looked to play sports. Always got cut from the little league teams. Got cut from trying out for the basketball teams. But I'd play in the parks and what have you. I wasn't one of those kids who, didn't engage in sports. I just wasn't that good at it. But I enjoyed it and had a good time. But I almost forgot. I'm going to tell you a story. After we moved to Tampa, this is like the first house of ours that we lived in. It was a modest home, certainly, split level and what have you. And soon after, within a year, my father bought something that you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. Hopefully, he bought me the World Book Encyclopedia. All 18 volumes.
Oh, wow.
All 18 volumes, right? And so you know what I did with the World Book Encyclopedia, Zuri?
You read them?
I read it from A to Z. I would sit down and read A, and then I'd go to B. And nobody told me to do this. It was meant to be a reference, you know, for writing papers and what have you. But, I never was really cut from the cloth of doing what everybody expected. But I read the encyclopedia. When I finished, I read it again. And you talk about being able to answer just damn near any question in class. You know, and when I graduated from, you know, we had junior high and then high school. Coming out of junior high, my nickname that was given to me was the walking encyclopedia. You know, and if you want to know stuff, you need to learn stuff. It was real simple, but it wasn't a chore. My parents never told me to do this. They never told me to do this. But in the course of certainly by junior high, you know, remember I told you that I called myself Dr. Ford as a little 4-year-old. I wanted to be a doctor, you know, and I wanted to be a doctor primarily because I didn't know of that, you know, of the universe of professions that are out there. There's a doctor. I never met any lawyers. I met doctors, of course. And, you know, I took all the necessary courses, but I took 4 years of violin lessons to improve my manual dexterity so that I would be a better surgeon. I was never a really great violin player, but I did. I took 4 years of Latin because they said you need Latin to go to medical school. I took, you know, the extra credit courses. I was at Rockefeller University in New York, taking special courses and all this. I really, really, really wanted to be a doctor. And now here's something that I would, you know, strongly suggest that you look into further, which is that the reason part of the reason why you're there, but definitely the reason why I was there, was, you know, by the time we're looking at college, it's like 1964, 65. And you ask people from the class of 64 and 65, it's like me, Bob, and Joe, you know, Dartmouth, right? There's not a lot of, you know, a lot of that going on. And that's true at all the Ivy League schools and higher level schools. Well, I did not know about really the Ivy League schools beyond the football scores and the fact that, there's a, Princeton had a very good NCAA team, and I knew about them. But I really didn't know about where to go. And I really, by the, I say it was 10th grade, I wanted to go to UCLA because they had good basketball teams. Not that I was going to play, but I was going to. And you know what happened? I happened to see some documentary about class at UCLA, school, going to UCLA, and they had a classroom with like 500 people. And I'm like, God, because at that same time in high school, I had my first bump in the road academically. I took physics and I got an exam back and it was an E, an F. I'd never seen that. Never. I was like, my God. And so my father told me, he said, he was a great guy. And he said, well, you need to go talk to the teacher and find out what you did wrong. And so I was like that with the teacher for the rest of, and by the end of the semester, I got an A. But I thought about it and, it's interesting. I was like 12, 13 years old. I figured this stuff out. And I said, if I was at UCLA, I'd die. There's 500 other people in the class and I need help. What would I do? And so I was really kind of trying to figure it out. And along came something called, and I asked you, just keep a note of this. It's called the National Scholarship Service for Negro Students. Okay, you Google that and you will find that this, for a really short period of time, this organization took steps with literally transformed not just academia, but America. And why do I say that? Because National Scholarship Service, some, good works people have found, funded at some foundation. And what they did starting about 64, 65, 64, certainly, they started identifying Black students. They call them Negro students then, right? Black students who had done well on the SAT scores, national merit scores, national achievement scores. That was another, just one of those, I couldn't dunk, but I could take a test. That's for sure. All those objective tests, it was just like, can I do another? I'd finish this. Can I do another one? get out of here. So that's how I came up on their radar. Because I was already, because my national merit scholars scores and achievement scores and then ultimately my SAT scores very good. In my senior year, every day that I came home from school, there was an offer from some school. I mean, I must have gotten 50-100 offers from colleges. But the National Scholarship Service for Negro Students, and I said, what are your interests, pre-med, this, that, and that. And they came up with schools that I had never dreamed of applying to. And so I had never heard of Johns Hopkins University, just never heard of it, Johns Hopkins, Dartmouth was in there. Brown was in there. Princeton was in there as well. And so in those days, you might only apply to four schools or so. And so it was like, damn, I didn't think you'd be able to get in these places. And I didn't change your bit. I went to my racist ass guidance counselor. And I'd say, how racist were these people? You remember, National Achievement. National Achievement Scholars that at your school, that the people who do really well, they get a national thing, right?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
But the ones who are really good, they get in their junior year. So in my junior year, I'm like, I'm 15 years old, right? And I'm in my junior year. And by the time that comes around, and you remember high school, right? And then, some kids are going to get it. And it was like, everybody knows that. And they skip my name as they call people to come to the auditorium. And it was like, and I went to my guidance counselor and he said, and finally they came back. He comes back to me and said, I can't make this stuff up. Your teacher said you academically did very, very well, but you're too arrogant. And I'm like, I'm only doing what the white kids are doing. I said, And you'd ask questions of the teachers that you knew the answer to just to embarrass them. I said, okay. But I wasn't the only one doing it either, And it was just that kind of, it was really, I went home in tears. And, you know, my father in particular, you know, just said, you know, this is a lesson for you, right? Don't let me, don't put your hopes and expectations with these people you do it here. I was so upset. I caught whooping cough. They hadn't had a case of whooping cough in New Jersey, Teaneck, New Jersey, in like 30 years. I was just devastated, but I came back, you know, and at that point I didn't give a shit about national achievement, Scott, or any of that kind of stuff, because I knew who I was, and it's like people can just go, well, we're being taped, so we just say, you know, it gave me a different kind of attitude. It's like, no, you know, because my father would tell me, you know, because I'd say the other kids would say, but you're not the other kids. You know, yeah, you know, you always be held to a different standard. And that's been true for my entire professional life as well. You'll always be held to a different standard. And anytime you don't think you are, you're going to get your feelings hurt. So don't do that. You know, so ultimately I applied to Johns Hopkins in Dartmouth and Princeton and Brown. And I was admitted at Johns Hopkins and Dartmouth and was not admitted at Princeton and Brown. And you go figure out why, right? It's one of the things I learned when a friend was working with admissions officers. It is, you know, once you get into that sphere, it's almost like roulette, you know, it's not, not you, it's them. And they've got all kinds of, you know, things. But interestingly enough, when I was 15 and I really wanted to go to Johns Hopkins because they had a BA MD program and you could be a doctor in 6 years. I'll be 22 and I'll be an MD and all that. And so my father drove me down to Baltimore in October and, you know, for a meeting with the guidance counselor, the admissions officer. And I had not, applied yet. Right. But I, you know, but he'd seen my file and what have you. And so, we talk and what have you. And when we finished, he said, okay, you're in. I said, what do you mean? You're in. You know, fill out the forms. fill out the damn forms. But I'm telling you, you're in. Okay. And so I always tell people, I was admitted to, you know, the BAMD program at the age of 15, which is true, you know, and that's where I was going. So the fact that I didn't get into Princeton, that's no problem. They didn't get Brown. That's fine. Dartmouth was there. And my very dear buddy, who sadly enough passed away about 3 years ago, brother, and we had gone through high school together, Dandre DeSandy's class of 70. We were both admitted to Dartmouth. And so I said, yeah, because I'm going to be too bad. I'm going to be in Baltimore, right? Mm-hmm. Well, here's where technology or the lack thereof can change your life. Because we only had I think we had three phones. It was a split level house. And so there's no one that you have your own phone or anything. And so my father overheard me talking about going to Johns Hopkins and how, you know, there are all these girls at Morgan and are going to go down to Howard. And then, and my father's, oh, hell to the no. We didn't do all of this work. This Negro is going to just go and wind up going to jail, you know? So but my father was cool because he did not say, don't go. Because then we would have, you know, by then, I'm a man. You know, that kind of thing. But they just said, but, you know, you might change your mind. I always want to be a doctor. Yes, but, you know, you might be better in another environment. Oh, he was good. He was good. And so with that, I changed and said I'm going to Dartmouth. And damned if I didn't change my mind, because I was definitely a biology major, pre-med to the core. But by fall of my sophomore year, I just wasn't feeling it anymore. And that's when I became a history major. So my buddy and I, Dandre and I, went to Dartmouth, and we get up to Dartmouth, and you know, we meet what was the second largest largest cohort of black men at Dartmouth ever, because the largest one before that was the class of 69. And so we beat them, I think, by about, you know, it was like 16 as opposed to 18, right? And there were about 60 on campus altogether by then. And you had what was called a critical mass. That goes back to what I was talking about, the National Scholarship Service for Negro Students. And why I think it's really important that you, you know, incorporate that somehow. Because this happened not only at Dartmouth, it happened at Amherst, it happened at Harvard, it happened at Columbia, it happened at Yale. And we started to get, because, you know, when you're only one, two or three brothers, you know, it's hard to, you know, demand anything except could you leave me alone, you know? Yeah. But as opposed to where now you have, you know, it's not a large community, but, you know, you're in Hanover. It's not, it's the only Black community in the state, you know? And so, you know, you start to, you know, you have enough of a critical mass and said, you know, we can change this place, not just get out of this place. We can change this place, you know? And I've always believed every place I've ever gone to school or work, I want that place to be different for because I was there in a good way, you know, and, you know, and so we had this critical mass, and it was for me the, how can I put it? It was just a wonderful experience in that, in all that schooling I told you about from K to 12, there's never more than two or three Black students in any class I was in. Mm. Never, you know, and so, and now then here's these brothers and they're reading Frantz Fanon and Camus and James Baldwin, and we can talk about stuff and what have you, as opposed to, you know, I mean, I hung out with my brothers and sisters who weren't in those advanced classes, you know, on the basketball court or parties and what have you. But I was like, you know, the bookworm that, you know, I mean, even as, you know, as I said, socialized and what have you, but, you couldn't talk to them about James Baldwin, for example. And I should say, parenthetically, I almost forgot this, and I certainly want this to you know about this. 1963 was the March on Washington, right? I was 13 years old at the time, and going into, I guess, the 10th grade, it would have been, yeah. And you know, it's coming up and what have you. And my parents said, you know, I was their contribution to the struggle. How much so they had to go to work that day. Okay. But they got a bus ticket for me to go to the NAACP bus out of Englewood, New Jersey, and went down to the March on Washington. And so I said, whatever else, you know, they may say, I was at the March on Washington, and there were so many people. Sorry, I never even saw the Capitol. You know, I never saw the stage.
Oh, wow.
I didn't hear Dr. King's speech till, that was like, I think it was a Wednesday. I didn't hear it till Saturday.
Oh, no.
Reporting going around. Yes, but it was okay, you know, because it was just that feeling. That, I mean, you know, and it's hard to convey it, you know, if you weren't there and during those times. But this had not happened before. You know, this is where all these Black people come into Washington, and white people too, from all over the country. And when you came from all over the country in those days, you know, that's like a 2-3 day, you know, flights and trips, what have you. It was no joke. And you know, I came home with this just great feeling. You know, they put, you know, your mother puts you on the bus with a bag of chicken, of course. Yeah. You know, you can't make this. You always have to have a bag of chicken if you go fly. You take a long bus trip, and it was just a great experience, and I feel very blessed that I was able to actually be there. You know, because, you know, it's one thing to watch it on TV; it's another thing to actually be on. I was there, obviously, for the whole damn day, and it felt good to be there, for sure. But back to Dartmouth, and so, you know, we're meeting these brothers. You know, so, you know, we're just freshmen. These brothers, just because they're upperclassmen, they're, you know, trying to, but they were really very. What's the word? Embracing, I guess, is the word. And that, you know, they're trying to introduce us to stuff, because we all came, you know, by and large, came from schools where it's like, you know, we're not talking about this, we're not talking about that, and, you know, notions of racism. I mean, I am not embarrassed to say, but I don't say it a lot, I came to Dartmouth supporting the war in Vietnam. I thought it was a great idea. And then somebody said, are you stupid? They didn't say that, but they said, here, read this. You know, understand what's going on over there, you know, and you know, once I read it, it's like, yeah, got that. And in spring of our freshman year, I have to laugh now, because it's 1967, and, you know, New Hampshire then was a big deal, because it was the first place in the presidential, you know, primaries and what have you. And so George Wallace came to town, you know, and it was like, you know, by now, you know, you know, most of us were in what was called the Dartmouth Afro-American Society. And, you know, so we joined, and, you know, basically a lot of it was, you know, meetings kind of talking about it, what to do. And, you know, we're still trying to figure out, you know, what to-do even looks like to change this place, because we all recognize that we were here as agents of change, although our parents, by and large, did not share that view. We're there for you to get an education and get the hell out of there, you know, and don't get these white people mad. And it's like, you know, they may have to get mad, you know. Mm-hmm. So George Wallace is coming, and, you know, again, you'd have to go in the Wayback Machine, Zori, and to understand how malevolent and evil a person this was, because, you know, I mentioned I was in March on Washington in 1963. I was in August and in September. You know, these little girls got blown up in the bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, under his administration. Mm-hmm. He stood in the doorway for it. I mean, he was just the living, breathing, satanic version, face of what racial segregation looked like. And now he's going to talk about running for president. And so he's coming to Dartmouth, and it's like First Amendment, forget that, you know. And so, you know, so we never really quite figured out what we were going to do. Something. And so one of the things we did was, you know, it was in Webster Hall. And so, some brothers got up with these sheets, you know, go home, Wallace, and we booed him and what have you. And finally, we made so much noise that he decided he had to leave. But that's when we went off script. Okay. That's it. Mm-hmm. Improvisation is the soul of jazz. It's also the soul of protest and change. We followed him out of Webster Hall. And he's getting in the car. And we surround the car. Okay? And we said, now this is, now with the security around presidential candidates today, they would shot us, you know, but they was still a little skimpy. He had a couple of, you know, Alabama state troopers with him and some other, but we surrounded the car. And now he's like, what are we going to do? And then we started to rock the car. And we were rocking the car, and you could see the wheels come, the tires coming off the pavement. And I was at the back of the car, and I saw his face, and the look on his face was, I can't believe I came all the way up to New Hampshire and these niggas are going to kill me, you know. And finally we kind of backed off and it went away. But that wasn't the end of the story. By the next, because CBS Sunday Night News carried it, and it was just all over the place, and they have it somewhere in the archives of Dartmouth, the letters from the alumni. Mm-hmm. The alumni, and have you seen those?
Mm-mm.
Okay, you asked for those. The alumni went nuts. Okay, it's like, you know, basically, first of all, we didn't even know you had niggers up there, right? I mean, this is out there right here. We didn't even know you had. Okay, what is going on? You know, send them all back to the jungle and what have you. You know, I mean, just really, I mean, these are Ivy League educated, you know, white men, and they were just, let me take off the mask and tell you who we really are. Mm-hmm. Right. Meanwhile, our parents were calling, you know, and like, what are you doing? You know, they're going to throw you out of there. Nobody's going to do that. You know? And it's like, you know, and so that was probably, you know, one of the more visible things that we did, you know, at least during my freshman year. But we were just getting warmed up because by the time, you know, now it's 67, 68, we actually had, I think it was called the Hinman Report had come out. And are you familiar with that, or you heard about it?
Mm-mm.
Okay, Hinman, the Hinman Report, which talked about dealing with, and it was generated by the college, which was talking about trying to deal with this notion of, you know, inequities and what have you, and what to do about it. And ultimately, that started to, transform our Afro-American society into just kind of like a fraternal organization, into an organization with purpose. Okay. Mm-hmm. By then I'm in my sophomore year. I think, you know, I was the minister of information, right? So like, you know, they're kind of modeling the Panthers kind of thing, I guess. And that becomes important in just a few moments. But we started to actually, you know, coalesce around things, focus on admissions, on faculty, on curriculum, and community service, you know, and all of these kinds of things were starting to, you know, gel. And so it's not just, you know, and so if we're going to do admissions, then we need to do recruitment. And so we're saying it's not enough for the folks who were there in the admissions office doing it. You need to have some of us go out to these schools and talk to these young brothers. We weren't talking to sisters yet, obviously, you know, and do that. And so now we're starting to see a little more of a, you know, you started by the next year, you started the class of 68, 69, you saw an increase in admissions, of course, but also, you know, there's a thought process going on right now in terms of, okay, what can we do about the curriculum? And, you know, the Black Studies programs are still very few and far between. But in the country at this point, but you know, we were, there's those of us who were looking at that, and now I had proposed, and it's one of the things that you can't go through life with regrets, sorry, but I wish that it had turned out differently, because one of the things, as you know, at Dartmouth is that if you want to work on the Daily D, you just have to show up, right? If you want to be on WDCR, you show up and you go through, right? And so my thought to the guys is like, we could take over this school, okay? We, within 2 years, we'd have people in the senior positions at the radio station, at the newspaper, and, go through all of those organizations. We can run this place, and I never was able to get that going. Obviously, I mean, it was bits and pieces, but we could have done that. But I was on the radio station. And I wrote for the school paper, and and I would, I interviewed Simon and Garfunkel when they came to town, and later Sly and the Family Stone, which is an interesting interview by any means that you consider, because this guy, he was so high. This is after the show. He was so high. It was like, and so was the entire band, and we're not going to talk about me, but they were, and it's like, Sly, I hear that you're going to Africa, right? Yeah, I'm going to Africa. And I said, what about that? Well, I'm going to play my music. And I don't like Africa. If Africa doesn't like it, forget Africa, and that kind of thing. So, but it was interesting because, it was a great opportunity. And then I was on the radio station and, which helped me amongst other things, just in terms of communicating, like we're communicating now. I've done hundreds of TV and radio interviews over the days, and once you get used to that microphone, once you get used to ignoring the microphone and just doing what you have to do, that's when you're on your way to do these things. So, any event, sadly, at the end of my sophomore year, which would have been April of '68, Martin Luther King was killed, right? And so, I remember getting word from, again, another one of our Dartmouth brothers, Charles Johnson, class of 71, comes into the room and says they just, I think, well, we were rehearsing. I was also acting there, doing acting there. And I'll tell you a little bit more about acting. But I was in one of the plays, and In White America, I think it was called. And he comes breaking into rehearsal and says, they just shot Dr. King. And so it's like, oh, shit. Okay, so everybody's like, what are we going to do? And my thought was, okay, we want to write a statement on behalf of the Afro-Am, and we're going to put it in the, put it on the radio right away. And so there's another departed brother's class of 70, Herschel Johnson, who's the best writer I ever knew. And if you can put his name down, please, and just Google him someplace along the line, Herschel, class of 70. He inspired me to do all of the writing that I've ever done. In I had my poetry published in a Random House collection of Black poets in when I was 19 years old, and I have two published novels now, and I write this. I told you about the column that I write, right? The blog, the Point of View blog. Did I tell you about that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Point of View, right? So which is now written. But anyway, so Herschel, I said, okay, Herschel, come on with me. We're going to the radio station, and we're going to write up a statement. And so it's like, everybody else in the radio station is white. It's like, we're going to make a statement on behalf of the Afro-Am. Okay. So we go in, and Herschel and I write this together. And I don't have a copy. I think it's in the Daily Dartmouth, some of you in the archives. And it was April 4th, 1968. So it had been April 5th, 1968. And it was pretty much a diatribe, I'd say, because we were mad. We were young and we were mad and pissed off. And, it's bad enough that you're saying Malcolm X didn't even go shoot King. And so the last line of this piece was, Black blood will no longer run in the streets alone. Okay. So you kind of get the tone, right? And so then they had me read it over the radio. So Herschel wasn't there. I read it over the radio. And then there was a Black Power conference and left town the next day. And, you know, that was still the big deal going on. Well, somebody got a hold of the actual copy. And two things happened. One, they put it in the Daily Dartmouth. So, again, if you look at the archives, it's in the Daily Dartmouth. And they did a memorial service at Rollins Chapel. So if you hadn't read it, there's a couple of brothers there, and they were passing out copies of it as people went into it. So it's like, oh my God. You know, and I'm out of town for the whole day. I come back on Sunday and says, man, the place is going nuts now. You know, and they actually canceled classes on Monday because this statement of ours caused all of this turmoil. I don't regret it because, you know, you know, there's such a thing as being too nice. And as a people, we're always too nice and we're always doing the right thing. And it's like, no, we're really pissed off. This is ridiculous. And I wasn't a big supporter of King, but that's okay, you know, or his policies. Although when you read about King's policies later on, you realize that he was a pragmatist. I don't think he really believed in nonviolence, but he just believed if we went the violent route, we'd all get killed. And that was kind of Gandhi's, you know, point as well, which was not that he believed in nonviolence necessarily, but the Brits had all the guns. You know, so you have to find another way. In any event, for the balance of the semester, I really couldn't show up at any public event without a fight breaking out. I mean, it was like really kind of weird. You know? And sometimes some of the brothers were with me and what have you. And, you know, and we gave as good as we got, obviously, in terms of this. And we weren't hiding from anybody or anything like that. And so by the end of my junior year, I guess they made me president of the Afro-Am going into my end of my sophomore year, going president, going into the junior. And so in many ways, I wound up being a lightning rod, if you will, for whatever was going on. But we stood the course and stayed the course. And we, as importantly as anything, you know, rhetoric aside, because rhetoric alone gets you just rhetoric. Rhetoric aside, we, you know, focused on these damn demands. And so we actually articulated, I don't know, it was like 16 demands, everything from, you know, we went, you know, and I tried to be strategic, and we tried to be strategic. You know, obviously we did this together, so I'd be very clear about that. One of the things I insisted upon is that, you know, to the extent it was possible for this small band of Black students, we were looking for institutional change. And that's not just admissions. So we wanted Black faculty. We wanted Black people in the administration. Okay, so we got Black people in the administration of Dartmouth for the very first time by 1969. And never been a Black person working, I think, Sam Smith that was in admissions. And then, you know, you have all kinds of Black people in admissions today. Okay, there was zero. There was zero. Okay, you know, and you know, we said, you know, obviously we want to increase in admissions, but we wanted to have special, you know, initiatives with respect to, you know, programs like going to, you know, we had people going to Sierra Leone or Jersey City and other kinds of, you know, that we wanted, and Mississippi, you know, the idea was that we wanted the college not to be so insular, you know, we wanted to go forward. And in my, when I came back in my junior year, because I spent the first part of my junior year in Jersey City, and Dartmouth had this teaching program there. You may want to look up. And when I came back, though, Dartmouth had, in their wisdom, there was a very wealthy Dartmouth alumnus in Chicago who was of the mind that the same skills that allowed somebody to become a general in the Army or president of the United States or United States Senator or corporate president were the same skills that gang leaders had. Okay, they just needed to be guided differently. So they brought about 18 of these brothers up to the school. You know, virtually all of them brought their pistols with them. Okay. Oh yeah, and they, the way that they had learned to survive and prosper was that you just challenge people right up front. But you don't challenge everybody. You find out who's in charge. That's who we're going to go. And so I was away in Jersey City, and they kept hearing about Wallet Ford. He's like, I come on, catch these brothers in my face. I'm like, oh, I need Wallet Ford, right? Yes, I know I can't run. You know, I can't fight these guys. And so you really try to front it off. We later became, you know, not later, gradually and very soon actually became good friends when they found out I didn't control anything that they wanted anyway. So we're literally friends to this day, you know, but what was interesting is that the white students couldn't tell us apart. right? In other words, so they, you know, they couldn't tell the black former gang members from the, you know, suburban, you know, blacks. They all look alike, right? Well, this got them in trouble because early on, legend has it that, you know, this white, you know, you're there on campus, these white guys are drunk, and they see these two brothers walking down Fraternity Row, and say, "Hey, boy," you know, something like that. And so the guy takes out a pistol and puts it in his mouth and says, "If you ever call me boy again, I'm going to blow your motherfucking brains out." And so, and then walks away. And it said, "Well, which one was it?" It said, "Well, we're not sure, so we better just leave them all alone because we're not sure." He had an afro and an army jacket. Well, that's pretty much all of them. So I said, "Well, which one? We don't know. So just leave them." Oh man, that was it. You know, it was very, very few confrontations after that. Of course, they knew I wasn't, so I still got sent out from time to time. But I thought it was hilarious because they just like, you know, as I said, well, you know, so about half of those guys, though, I must say, actually did complete their studies and graduate and get degrees from Dartmouth. When you consider they were starting to, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, they had to do remedial reading and all this kind of stuff just to get to do college work. And I have, you know, all the respect in the world for the brothers that, you know, came through with that. So we, again, continued to pursue those demands. And by the spring of 69, we actually had, you know, hammered out in negotiations with the administration. That's, you know, I was heading up the team where we, you know, and you know, I learned, you know, kind of learned by doing negotiating skills, which have helped me to this day, which is that, okay, you know, there's 10 things I want, but I've got to get these five. And if I can get these other two or three, we're doing okay. So you give away something, but you keep something over here and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I was 19, you know, just really kind of figuring it out at the time. And so we ultimately put together a set of demands that you know that you know about, and had to take it in front of the faculty for the faculty approval. And I look back now, and I said, yeah, I had like this safari jacket and all the hair in the world. I have to send you the photo, all the hair in the world, and a cigar. A cigar. I didn't smoke a cigar, but I just said, you know, Castro smoked a cigar. I don't really bring a cigar. And gave this presentation, and it passed. And so it was done. It was done. And so by the fall, we had our first full black professor, Errol Hill, who later up headed the drama department. We had a black studies program. Robert Mick McGuire headed that up. We had increased it. The number of black students that came in and September of 69, which would be class of 73, it was like over 100 brothers. So now we just like what I said before, we want to transform this institution. It's never going to be the same after that. And I'm comfortable in saying that we, because it certainly wasn't just me, but we as a collective group were able to do this, because I have to go back to when we were doing those demands, it wasn't like a done deal. And if you, again, go through the archives, it was around the time that the students at Cornell took over a building with rifles. Made the front page of Time magazine, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so brothers, we had our Afro-Am meetings every week. It was always just, you know, really, you know, made for TV. And said, so we ought to take over a building. You know, now here I am. I'm supposed to be the militant brother. I said, listen, we are the largest black community in New Hampshire, okay? If we lock ourselves in a building, what do you think is going to happen then? You know, the last thing we want to do is lock ourselves in a building. You know, I was like, okay, right. You know, I said, you got to be kidding. Because a couple of weeks earlier, the white students, the SDS, Students for Democratic Society and Anti-War, took over Parkhurst. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But they took over Parkhurst, and we were the Afro-Am said, no, you know, first of all, we're not taking over, you know, not taking over buildings. It's not a good strategy up here in New Hampshire, maybe in Columbia or someplace, but not up here in the woods, because the state police are not playing, right? You know, and so, you know, but I did visit and go inside Parkhurst to show solidarity, but I'm not staying there. And so, with it, you know, overnight, they sent in the state police, knocked down the door of Parker's, and pepper sprayed them and tear gassed them and dragged out. These are sons of alumni. Okay. They had a court set up at Hanover High School. And by the afternoon, these guys were in prison all over the state, the prisons all over the state. Okay. I mean, it was like bang, bang, bang. And they were in prison. And my roommate, who was white, was part of that. And they shaved his head. And all, I mean, took him out there. And I mean, he was the son. His father was, you know, there's a, was the founder of a shoe line. It's probably not even around here. It was a women's shoe line, Geller Shoes. I mean, it was a big deal at the time. I mean, he was a wealthy kid, right? And it didn't matter. Took them all, sons of alumni. And so I remember saying to the brothers, you see what they did? What do you think they would have done to us? You know, we'd be happy to go to prison. You know, and you're in prison with people. What are you in for? I'm here for raping sheep, you know, and that kind of thing. So it was a lesson to be learned. You have to apply the strategy to the terrain. And but ultimately we were able to, you know, get the demands passed. And, that was a big deal. I mean, it's changed, you know, a lot of the changes we've seen, whether it's, you know, the increased number of females generally, because that was like the next big thing, because, well, okay, you know, black people in there, now we need the women. And it said, well, no, actually we need black women in, you know, and, of course, there's still a continuing struggle. I must add, though, as I'm telling this narrative, because as I said, as a disc jockey on the radio station, and I'm trying to edit my comments here because of it, but I don't really have to. The way that it works at WDCR, I think it still does to this day, is that you have to start off like with the hard stuff, which is doing the 6 a.m. morning show, and then you have to do like Best of Broadway and this, and then Rock and Roll, and then finally, you know, you kind of have a little bit more freedom with the 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock show, because that's when they turn off the transmitter, right? So I had done all of those shows along the way, and I never remember as a freshman opening up the station at 6 a.m. and giving the weather report, and it's like it's 30 below zero. We're going to have a high of 15 below zero today. And I was like, what did that just say? It is like, yes, it got to zero. And people were like, oh, man, you know, you get this, you know, tanning spray, you know. So, and all the way through. And so by the time of, you know, the last semester of my junior year, and I'm like one of the senior members at WDCR now. So I said, so they came up with all the various slots, and you want this, you know. And I said, you know, and I didn't choose any of them. And they said, oh, what are you going to do? I said, I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to go on when typically, because there's no law that said we had to close it down the transmitter. I want to go on at 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. And I'll just go as long as I want, and I'll play whatever I want. So I said, oh, okay. So I had an extensive record collection of all kinds of genres, what have you. And the first night we went, my roommate, the guy who ultimately got arrested and went to prison, for that Parker's business, we went out to a commune someplace in Vermont, and the details aren't important. The point is that about quarter to one, so aren't you supposed to be doing a show tonight? I had already told the people at the station, because all this had happened that night. I said, there's a album, and there's a record called Listen Here by Eddie Harris, and it's about an 8-minute song. And as I said, just start playing that before the song is over, I'll be there. Right? You know, and so you could do that stuff, right? So we're driving back and slipping on the ice, and this is, you know, and so we get to, by the time we get into Hanover, they're already playing the theme song, right? And it's like, oh shit, that's a, so we're gonna running, I'm running up the stairs to the studio, and the announcer before me said, stay tuned, Wally Ford, stay tuned, folks, because, you know, Wally Ford has got a brand new show, and the name of his show is, and that's when I walked in the door and said, hey, what's happening, the What's Happening show, you know. And that's how we got it in. And so for the rest of the semester, I'd go till like 2-3 in the morning. Obviously my classes were really in the morning at this point, and you know, people would drop by, and it became like a thing. You know, the firehouse, the people at the fire station, they would call. Truck drivers would call, call in. It was like a thing for a while. You know, so but So as I said, I was doing that. I was writing for the school papers. I was acting in plays. But it should be let the record show that I did maintain my academic standards. I was dean's list and what have you, and ultimately became a senior fellow going into my senior year. And I should also mention, yes, in my junior year, while I was down in New York doing that Jersey City stuff, I joined a black theater company in Harlem, and so I was acting there. This is my first professional acting stint. And I have to laugh now. I say, what was that? I commuted between Dartmouth and Harlem every week winter and spring semester. I'd go to school and leave Thursday afternoon and fly to New York and perform Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then fly back on Sunday. I think I was taking extra courses that semester and made dean's list and all that. And I said, don't try this at home, folks. Right. You know? But I had a great time and I really enjoyed acting. But you know, when I was coming out of getting ready to graduate, you know, it's not a 69, 70. The roles for black actors were things like I Shot My Mama Part 2, you know, Superfly Part 7. And it's like, you know, I know. So that kind of squashed my acting career. But in any event, so I was doing all of these things. And I said I was senior. And so I became a senior fellow. And we had a string of folks getting the Rhodes Scholarships, right? Black guys. And I did not apply for the Rhodes Scholarship, which I believe this is where mentorship is so important, because there's nobody to say, listen, you know, because why didn't I apply? Because Cecil Rhodes made his money off the backs of black people in Africa, and I don't want that money. And it's like, the money has been made, brother. You know, so you take some of that money and go do something with it. But there's nobody to tell me that at the time. And so who knows where I would. But we had a string of brothers already doing it. And next year, brother got it as well and so on. But I don't, you know, as I said, you can't live with regrets. But I did become a senior fellow and did a senior fellow piece that was on black political history in America. And so I didn't have any classes, obviously, in my senior year. And I was able to lecture black history. I guess it was African-American history course or American history course. And we did focus on black history. So I was a guest lecturer at Dartmouth. It wasn't just hair and running around. We did a little bit more than that, you know, trying to do that. And at the time, Zuri, I was going into my senior year because I said I'd stopped wanting to be a doctor. And by then I said, I think I want to be a college professor because I, you know, studied black history. But by the time I became going into my senior year, I said, you know, with my quote radical background, and obviously not as radical as what's going on today, but you know, I'll never get tenure. I didn't even really know what tenure was. And I never really got good guidance on this because, you know, I'm nowhere near as radical as some of the people who did get tenure, that's for sure, who have gotten tenure over the years. But yeah, he said, you know, and I regret that I didn't get better guidance on some of these things. He said, you know, you write well, you know, you read well, you speak well, what have you. Why don't you go to law school? I'm like, I don't want to go to law school. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, Perry Mason and stuff. I never go to law school. He says, a lot of things you can do with a law degree other than being a lawyer. And with that, I applied to Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Stanford and Berkeley law schools. Just with that, you know, and wound up being admitted to Berkeley's law school, Columbia's law school, and Harvard's law school. And like I said, just the same with college. I wasn't admitted to, I was put on Yale's waiting list and was rejected at Stanford. If you can figure out what the metrics were to do that, you know, you're smarter than a lot of people. But, you know, so, and this is kind of like the denouement to this story, which is that obviously I got admitted, I guess in April, May, what have you. I was trying to figure out where to go to school. And I wanted to go to Columbia because I had an offer to be a disc jockey on the radio station here in New York, right? And I have to laugh. And I said, what was I thinking? And I was also offered a gig with the radio station in San Francisco, where you've heard of Sly and the Family Stone, right?
No.
No. Okay, you can Google him as a slat. He was huge, but he was a disc jockey before he became a performer. And he was on a radio station as they had offered me. So my thought was I was going to go to Stanford and or to Berkeley and be a disc jockey in the day, you know, at night and be at school during the day, which would have, you know, we wouldn't be having this interview today because I'd just probably be living in a tent somewhere, something like that, you know. And so, but I was going to do the same thing in New York. And the people at Columbia Law School said, well, we can't give you a dormitory because your mother was still living in Teaneck, New Jersey. Your mother lives within 60 miles, so you have to stay at home. And I said, why would you do that to my mother? I haven't been home in 4 years. And they said, no. So I was at Columbia was out. So I'm thinking I'm going to go to Bolt out there and not go to Harvard because I didn't like Boston. And so I was working for a record company that summer, and he had me talk to their lawyer who had actually gone to Harvard Law School. And he was a good guy because he didn't say, what the hell's wrong with you? Yeah, he's a white guy. But he said, but, you know, there's a lot of benefits to going to Harvard Law School, and you really ought to think about that. Yeah, and so I thought about it. And so, yeah, so I said yes to Harvard Law School. So the upshot of that story, though, is that, and this is where, you know, there's mysteries in our lives, which is that, you know, Teaneck is in a suburban community. You know, there's suburban papers, and you may have seen it's like, you know, Zuri Moy, you know, daughter of such and such is graduated from, who lives at such and such, is graduating and is going to school. Yeah, right. So it was like that for me, except that my mother had moved to 28 East Maple Street, never forget. But she put a piece in the paper, but it said 26 East Maple Street. So my mother said, oh, they got it wrong. I said, don't worry. When they go to firebomb us, they're going to hit the white people next door. Ha, ha, ha. Right? You know, so in those days, it took about 6 weeks to change your magazine subscription. This is 1970. It wasn't like just over. And so I had this thing that I had to have my Sports Illustrated subscription to be able to succeed in law school as in college. Always had that. Right? And so and now it's like July, and you know I still don't have a dorm assignment, and so I call you know Harvard Law School, and ultimately get the assistant dean, who ultimately later became the dean of Howard Law School, and then the president of Fisk University. And he says, "Wallace, yes." I said, "Wallace Ford, yes." I said, "We have a letter here from you saying you're not coming." And I'm saying, "Okay, now you know may have." You know, had a few moments in time, but I know I didn't read the letter. So you read the whole letter to me, and it's like, not only am I not going to, I don't want to go to law school, take me off the list. I don't want to be on a waiting list. I'm joining the Marine Reserves. I'm moving to St. Louis, where I'd never been, and on and on. And so I'm reading this, and I'm like, wow. And so, you know, this is my guardian angel said, ask him to read the entire letter, 26 East Maple Street, not 28. So I said, so I could prove that over the phone, and they put me back. Because I was out of the class. So they had to bump somebody on the waiting list to put me back in. And so I was out of the class. And, they sent me the letter, the signature. I have a signature, you know, as we all do. And it wasn't even an attempt at forgery. And and the address in St. Louis was an empty lot. Okay. And I said, this is not a prank. Okay, this is not a prank, but this is, you know, this is the times that by now the Nixon administration is in full blown, you know, and you don't have to be Huey Newton or somebody for them to be obviously on somebody's radar list and really, you know, tried one of those career damaging incidents. And it was all based on my activity at Dartmouth, of course. So, you know, it's one of those things. But I would say, you know, the one thing. That I said, and the reason I sent you that commencement speech, Zori, is because it just occurred to me. I was running around doing a bunch of stuff. I said she needs to see this speech, and the reason is because by May of our senior year, you know, brothers who were there, you know, and you know the class before we had a graduate about the same. We were maybe two or three more, but you know, we just said, look, you know, we went to the dean and said, you know, our parents are coming. You know, and all the things, and there's no black speakers, and there should be a black speaker. Mm. And so the dean was all right, well, fine, you guys decide who it's going to be. So we go huddle, and it's like, okay, you, Wallace, you get to do it. Great. All right. So I had this job in New York, and and I was through doing my senior fellowship, senior fellowship, and my presentation and all that went well. And so I was working in it, and so I had to drive back, you know, to like a day or two. June 14th was graduation. That was a Sunday. I guess I got back on Friday. And this is something I do not encourage you or anybody else to try to do, but I don't do drafts. I don't do that. I write and that's it. You know, and it's a gift or a curse, I don't know, but I don't do drafts. So I wrote this speech, and I was trying to balance in the fact that, okay, you know, it's like 5,000 white people in our parents there, and it's time that we can just tell you what you need to be told. On the other hand, it's our parents there, right? You know, and so and I don't want the brothers mad at me. You said that in front of my mother, you know. So you got to try to find this balance. And so I was working on it, and because it was going to be published in the D, I had to get it to the editor, I don't know, like at noon the next day or something like that. So I hand it to him, and I'm thinking, I'm not changing a word. You can't make me do it. You know, and he finishes it, he says, Wally, and he's looking up at me. I said, yes, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever read. I'm like, what? You're not supposed to be saying it. So if you go into the Daily D archives, the speech is there. That's not the speech I gave. It's pretty much the speech I gave. I kind of punched it up a little bit. But the speech I gave you is the speech I gave. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I'll never forget that day, of course. My parents were there. My friends, my brother's parents were there. And, you're standing, you know, everybody else is getting to sit together. I'm sitting up on the stage with this guy who was the valedictorian that nobody had seen for 4 years. You know, like, who are you, man? And never seen this guy for 4 years. So he's about, you know, so you're the one with the 5.0, right? You know, so, so I remember giving the speech though. And, it was one of those moments, I was only 20 years old. I have to put that in that context, you know. But I never felt 20. I just felt like this is where I was supposed to be. And, I remember, and, you know, the last lines of the speech are, to you mothers and fathers, your sons are now with you, you know, and bang. And so there was dead silence. You imagine the green is dead silence. Mm. And then the brothers got up, you know, 12 of them, and they gave a little standing ovation. And then everybody got up. Wait a minute. Did you hear what I just said? You know, and so, it was really quite a moment. And, you know, as a parent now, you know, I'm just so pleased and so blessed that, my parents got to see that, you know, take a moment here. Yeah, because they both passed away now, of course. But I just think about it. Remember, I told you a story. You know, I was a little kid in Japan. Mm. And just a moment. To see things turn out the way they did. And, of course, there's still chapters to be written. But, you know, to think that they got to see that is probably the one of the great blessings of life. They were able to do that. And to be able to do that with, I grew up an only child. So the brothers I went to school with were my brothers, you know. Mm. And they were, to a man, everybody, you know, thought it was a great thing. So we, that was surprising. I didn't think I would get emotional over this, but... Okay, so you're gonna cut that part of it, right? So,
yeah, I got you. I got you.
I'm kidding. That's all right. Yeah. So yes, if you're not human, then you never cry, right? Mm. You know. And so, glad they ascribe to being human. But it's like 20 years later, 25 years later. So yes, 25 years later, I go to my 25th reunion, and up in Hanover, of course, and one of my classmates, white, says to me, I read your speech to my son. Huh. And I said, oh, you know, wow. Like, yeah, you know, and because there's no question, there was a lot of animosity. I mean, my picture would be on a poster. They'd set the poster on fire, you know. I mean, some guys tried to run me over one night after the radio on Mass Row. You know, they missed. When I tell this story to some folks, I said, you know, sometimes even if somebody doesn't agree with you, if you just tell the truth in a way that they can understand it, they have to respect it. Mm. They may not, you know, they may still not agree with you, but you have to respect that. Yeah, you kind of, you know, and, you know, as I said, those last lines just, you know, the last lines come from a poem by my departed brother, Herschel Johnson, you know, which is, mm-hmm. for you mothers, I changed to you mothers and fathers, your mm-hmm. sons are now with you. And it's like, bang, there you go. So we're still at it, Zori, after all of these years. And, you know, I don't know, what's next on the agenda, but, you know, these days I'm a college professor after doing all these many other things in life. And I, you know, which of course you recall, I said I wanted to be all those years ago. And I wound up back in higher education on a whim. I happened to be at Columbia's School of International Affairs talking to the former mayor that I'd worked for, and somebody I'd worked with in this New York State governor's office happened to see me walk by. I said, "Hey, Wally, you know, would you like to teach a class this semester?" Mm-hmm. And I always tell people it is a very good thing that I was not born female, because I find it very hard to say no, you know. And so I said yes. And but I got to tell you, the first time I stood in front of a class, after all the things that I'd done, I've been in government, I've been an investment banker, I've been a lawyer, and, you know, government officials, and international law, and all of this stuff, this voice said, "This is what we want to do." And mm-hmm. so it took me almost 10 years to get to be a full-time professor, because you had to climb the ladder from being an adjunct. And all this. I was fortunate, because I had a JD, that was counted for PhD purposes, because I never would have done otherwise. And then you had to climb the ladder to get tenure, and I got tenure last year. I think I was the oldest person in the City University of New York to get tenure at 71. Because usually if you get tenure, you're in your 30s or 40s, maybe mm-hmm. you're in your 50s, but my trajectory is different. And as you heard me say, you know, for years, I was the youngest person to do whatever it was, you know, whatever it was, you know, 20 years old, graduating from Dartmouth, 16, getting out of high school, you know, 23, getting out of law school, and so on. And then you see this kind of happening where people who are your peers were born 20 years, you know, later than you were born, 30 years later. And then it's like, okay, we don't need to talk about it anymore. Mm. You know, and but I've been blessed with good health. You know, I've, you know, I'm glad that I've, you know, because you know, I had great parents, I'd like to think, I do believe I've been a good dad, and which is, you know, in many ways as important as anything else that I've ever done or ever will do. I got into writing. I think I told you I have two published novels, which is like where Dartmouth actually is in the first novel. I think some of the people say graduate of Dartmouth or something like that, and so on. But done that, and it's done radio, done TV, never done any movies. Although, I got to tell you, yes, and there's one other thing I have to tell you about, because before my junior, I spent the summer of my junior year before, I guess, my senior year started in Ghana. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but we have to go back before that, which is that we had our, you know, so we did a lot of stuff coming out. We had our first Black Arts Festival in my sophomore year. You familiar with the Black Arts Festival?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, fine. So I was part of the organizing committee for that. And we had a Black Arts Festival. Ebony came up and covered it. That was a big deal. And that's when your parents still had Ebony magazine on a coffee table and all that kind of stuff. And so because I was part of the organizers, I was with the reporter that was doing all of this stuff. And, you know, it was in February. You know, Minnecarl was in February. And so I came down in March for spring break and went to see him. I'm looking for a job. Right. And so I'm sitting there. His name is Peter Bailey, who is a very close associate with Malcolm X. And you read some of the, you know, autobiographical information about Malcolm X. And I'm sitting there talking about trying to get a job at Ebony for the summer. And he starts to look at me like this. And he says, "My God, you have the same eyes. You have the same smile." I'm like, what are you talking about? And he says, you look just like Malcolm X. Now, I had heard it from time to time, but, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, I don't know if anybody's told you you look like anybody, but when you look in the mirror and brush your teeth, you see Zori, right? I don't know what you're talking about. You know, and so it's like, whoa, you know, because I had a poster of Malcolm X up in my, as everybody did in your dorm room and what have you. And it's like, well done. Thank you very much. So you should play the part of Malcolm X in the movie. Because they were making them, but this is 1968. They were making a movie. 20th Century Fox was going to be making a movie. James Baldwin was doing the screenplay, and Betty Shabazz had asked Peter to oversee the manuscript, this screenplay, so that James Baldwin's, shall we say, his personal, you know, preferences did not come out. He had a Malcolm X story, right? And so he said, "You need to meet Betty Shabazz because she'll see that you play young Malcolm in the movie." Now, again, I'm 18 years old. My God. So because I was in New York over that fall semester, we ultimately arranged for Betty Shabazz and I to meet at a restaurant here in Harlem. It's called the Red Rooster, you know. And so I come over from Jersey City. I only have one suit, you know, and only one dress shirt and only one tie. And it was blue with green polka dots. And, you know, I had all the hair in the world. And, you know, and I get there early. And I'm at the bar, standing at the bar waiting, and I don't, you know, the only thing I drank was Boone's Farm wine, right? You know, the good vintage, right? you know, last week's vintage, right? And so, I'll have scotch on the rocks, as I've seen on TV. So they give you scotch on the rocks. So I'm taking a sip, and in walks Peter with Malcolm X's widow and Amira Baraka's wife. This is all the blackness in the world is coming. I'm standing here with this damn drink in my hand. So I sit down with them, and it may have been about one of my worst encounters ever with anybody that I cared to make a good impression on. I ordered pork. So she looked at, you know, if you knew Betty Shabazz, she looked at you like, just let me die, Lord. You know, and that was the high point. It just got so bad. You know, and that by the time we finished, it was like, it's no longer could I play the part in the movie. It's like, can I stay in the black race? You know, that's all I'm gonna do. So we fast forward now, and, you know, you're 18, and it's like, you're not going to let that, you know, depress you. So I'm out in Ghana. My father's working for the State Department, and I could come out as dependent. I was taking courses at the university in Accra. And I'm walking across campus one day, and I got course credit, by the way, for at Dartmouth for it. And I'm walking across the campus, and I see what is clearly two sisters who are American sisters. You know, you can tell by the hair and dress. And so, you know, I was taught to be polite. And so I'm walking by and saying, "Hello, how are you?" And one of them says, "Hello, Wally." And you ever have it happen? And he's like, somebody's talking, and you do not know who the hell they are. He's like, "Oh God, what?" You know, I'd like to think my skills are a little better now, but then it's like, I'm done. And it's just, I'm going to tell Peter Bailey you saw Betty Shabazz and didn't know who she was. I'm like, oh no, it's worse. It actually got worse. No. You know? So, my father, I was literally distraught, and my father was coming at the embassy, and my father attended, and he said, he talked to Betty Shabazz, and he said, "You know, my son's really upset." She said, "Tell him it's okay. She said, you know, the resemblance was just jarring. You know, her husband wasn't dead more than 2 years, so in walks this ghost, if you will. And so, you know, but tell him we're fine. Son's fine. So we now fast forward. About 12 years later, I'm working for Inner City Broadcasting. This is a black-owned company, and Percy Sutton is a major figure here in New York. And on the board of directors is Betty Shabazz. He was Malcolm X's lawyer and the family lawyer. Now, what did I do? I lost you someplace along the line. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, you're still there. I can't find. What the hell happened here? Okay, we're getting there. Okay. Do you want to delete this item? No. Okay. So, our job was, I was vice president of this small investment company, and we'd invest in black-owned companies around the country, and we'd ask to have board members on the, so I was on the board of this company in LA, and he put Betty Shabazz on. And so we would fly across the country about 3-4 times a year, and, we were good then, you know, we had a great time, you know, and you know, she said, yeah, you know, by then, this is like years later, she said, you know, actually, you're a little taller, but he was a little bigger in the body. But we didn't spend a lot of time, but we'd just talk about stuff. And so she would refer to me as the son she never had, which I thought was very nice because she had these five daughters. And so now we fast forward a few years later, and I run into her at some reception. She says, well, how's your wife? And I had been married and didn't work out. So I said it didn't work out. She said, oh, I've got five girls. Do you want a tall one? You want the short one? You want? No. I cannot see myself dating Malcolm X's daughter. I got his poster up and I just can't do it. So she prevailed, and we did have a blind date. And a very beautiful woman, Ilyasa. And I'm sitting there, and she sits down. She comes in, and the restaurant, we sit down. And it's like one Mississippi, two Mississippi. She says, you do look like my father. I said, check, please. Let's go. No, so actually, we've remained friends, but we not dating or anything like that. I just can't wrap my head around that. But these are some of the stories that come out of just being around Dartmouth, you know. I mean, all kinds of stuff happens, for sure. You know, I met Judith Jameson because Alvin Ailey, we brought Alvin Ailey up to Dartmouth. Company, we brought her up, you know, and so met Judith sitting there in the hop having a cup of coffee. We were just sitting there chatting before she became Judith Jameson, right? And all that kind of stuff. So we're very, you know, it was a great experience. Don't regret it. I appreciate more than anything the fact that we've been able to maintain the brotherhood, not just of the guys who were there at the time, because sadly several have passed away now and what have you. But we have this, you've heard about the Hanover Partners.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Okay, so that's you heard about BATA, of course.
Right? Yes.
Okay, but Hanover Partners is a more informal group of just brothers from my day on to now, and we meet every 2 weeks, just to kind of camaraderie, brotherhood, not worried about Robert's Rules of Orders and all that kind of stuff, but just, you know, kind of maintaining contact and what have you. And we should have you as a guest, just to kind of talk about what you're doing. It's a Zoom every two weeks. I think it'll be next week, as a matter of fact. You have Zoom as well, right? Because I don't know what this platform is. We're all, you know. Because I think it's, you know, not that you're talking to me, but that the kind of work that you're doing. Because I think it's really important because, you know, for two reasons. One is every generation grows up thinking they just discovered shit. Right, you know, it's like, oh, there's the sky. I didn't know we ever saw the sky before, right? It's like, well, maybe not, you know. And there's certain common strains with respect to the struggle, whether it's 1915 or 2015 or today. There's common strains because you always have people who are looking to try to accommodate, and people are looking to change in a more drastic way, and then there's people who are looking to, you know, find some middle ground. I think that it is it's important to have that. I mean, I wish I knew what the brothers in 1925 were thinking, for example. You know, in 1920 would be 50 years ago. So you actually have an opportunity to talk to people from 50 years ago who are still alive and relatively well. I think it's a benefit because it gives you perspective, you know, because there's very little, there's very little that's new under the sun. Strategies that worked before still work now. But as I hope you've heard me say, more than anything, you know, the struggle continues. It is not, you know, I think there's no time to think about spiking the ball or breaking the tape. And I have strongly concerned about the fact that we're actually looking at a regression. And, you know, if you see the, you know, if in 2024, the Republicans control the Supreme Court, the Senate, you know, the House and the presidency, it's not going to be a very good time for black people. The 13th Amendment is on the table. And I'm not kidding. You know, it sounds like, oh, they never give. You know, they won't allow slavery again. But if you read the 13th Amendment, says that people cannot be enslaved except if they're convicted of a crime. So, all right, so why do we even need that anymore? Nobody's doing slavery anymore. You know, you start peeling away, you know, protections that you thought were for granted, it can be very difficult. It is why I became a history major, in large part, is just to learn because they said those who do not know history are condemned to repeat it. And, you know, there's just things that you and your, you know, colleagues and contemporaries, you know, want to know not just what's in the book, but the experiences that people had, because, you know, I'm not big on, well, we did this and we did that, but that there's common experiences. So how did we get past it? I hope I've been able to share some of those with you. We didn't get past it, but we were able to get success because we did not accept no for an answer. Mm. It's really interesting when you just say, well, no, we're not accepting no for an answer. You know, what do you mean to ask him? No, we're not accepting no for an answer. We'll stay here all day. We'll come back tomorrow. You know, it is really important, you know, that people, you know, keep that in mind as well. So there we are. So as I say, aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? Right. You know, so it's just, you know, it's Mr. Lincoln, you should ask Mr. Lincoln. Right. You know, but anyway, is there anything you want to ask me, Zuri? Because literally I've been doing all the talking. So is there anything you want to ask me?
Yeah, I would kind of like to know your current impressions of Dartmouth today as you've come back to visit and from afar. What is kind of your perspective as an alum now that you've graduated? and if there's anything you would change or?
Well, I think there's always a, I'm trying to think, the last time I was up at the college was probably about 4 or 5 years ago, but obviously I keep track with what's going on. I've attended board of trustee meetings via Zoom and all of this stuff. And I think there's a danger in thinking that we have won. Okay. You know, because you do see more Black people there, but you know, Black people identify differently than when I was there. When I was there, you're Black, you're Black. Now I said, well, you're African, you're from the Caribbean, mixed race, which is something I just, you know, frankly, just don't even understand, you know, because, you know, no police officer in America believes in it. That's for sure. And I hate for people to find that out the hard way, you know, that mixed race does not play. And this country doesn't acknowledge mixed race in any legitimate fashion. I did a lot of work in South Africa where mixed race, called colored, was indeed codified. And that produced a tremendous split in the what was then had been the Black community, the non-white community. And if you think about, you know, we dodged a bullet here in the U.S. in that because white people, you know, adopted the one drop rule. You know, I don't care if you're a light, bright kind of white, what have you, or you can't see you in the dark. Everybody's in that same position. But if we had the colored or mixed race rule in place, then let's think about it. Frederick Douglass wasn't Black. Okay. W.B. Du Bois wasn't Black. Duke Ellington wasn't Black. You know, shall I go on? I mean, you know, the list goes up. You know, Walter White wasn't Black and so on and so on. And Barack Obama certainly wasn't Black, right? And I don't think we need that at this point. I think people who identify that way typically are going to get their feelings hurt someplace along the line and perhaps in a very difficult way. But I think that the emphasis on, how can I put this usefully, the emphasis on white women's rights, I think, has, you know, supplanted a lot of the concerns about the rights of Black people, men and women, because I don't know that Black women are necessarily being kept in mind when we're talking about, you know, now it's 53% female. Okay. Mm-hmm. And obviously you get counted in that number, but I don't know if that translates into, you know, board positions or faculty positions or even just how do you, what do you think, Zuri? You know, when do you get brought into, you know, other Black females get brought into the conversation? And so, you know, I'm concerned that, you know, there's ways that you can kind of, you know, divide up a grouping that just is confronted, you know, totally in a very, what's the best way I can put it, is confronted in a very comprehensive fashion, you know, and I said before, and I was not even joking, you know, you can be, say you mixed race all you want. You get stopped by a cop on the highway on your way to Boston. They're not looking at mixed race. They're looking, you know, mm-hmm. you know, maybe, I guess, if you could pass, I guess, you know, whatever. But you get the point. You know, I just think that, you know, the, you know, people, you know, identify by their fraternity and their sorority and, you know, all kinds of other, you know, ways, which, you know, and I don't knock any of that. I think that's great. But mm-hmm. I think that you know, there's got to be some basic reasons for collective, you know, yeah, for a collective relationship among mm-hmm. people who are Black, you know, and you know, and if only for self preservation, but also for self for advancement, you know. I mean, you know, if you want to, the best thing that could happen, the people who do not want to see progressive change take place at Dartmouth is for the Black community to balkanize. Okay, because it's that, then you don't have a unified front. We you know, as I said, yeah, it sounds like the old man and the sea, but back in my day, we just didn't have those fractions. The African brothers were with us, and, mm-hmm. you know, light skinned brothers were with us, and this, mm-hmm. whatever, because we recognized that you know, collective, you know, a collective action would benefit all of us. And mm-hmm. If you start splitting it up, you know, say, well, I'm a Q, I'm an Alpha, I'm a Delta, mm-hmm. whatever. It's mm-hmm. like, great, that's all well and good, but can we come together under some, you know, some basic umbrella in terms of the concerns? And I guess that's a long answer to your question. But, you know, the other part is just that, you know, it's no time to spike the ball. I mean, you know, there's hardly any Black faculty, full-time mm-hmm. faculty, you know, tenured faculty. Why? In part because nobody wants to move up to Dartmouth with their family and live there for, you know, next 10 years in those kinds of circumstances, mm-hmm. Unless there's a notion that there's a community that is welcoming and, you know, prepared to embrace their presence. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Dartmouth is not the only place that's, you know, not in an urban center, but I think, you know, we, you know, in the activities I'm doing with the Black alumni, we could do a lot better with respect to, you know, faculty for sure, different kinds of programs. I don't know, maybe I'm just missing it that, you know, like I said, we had the Black Arts Festival and, you know, all the kinds of things that, you know, just kind of, we did that in part to say, we are here. Mm. We are here. And mm-hmm. I think that's important.
So. Do you have any advice for Black students currently attending Dartmouth right now? Because I feel like as a 24, I feel partly because of the pandemic and partly because of other factors, Black students at Dartmouth are kind of at a point where it's divided in a way. As you kind of hinted to with like being like, I'm an Alpha or I'm a Q or I'm a Delta, I'm an AKA. Do you have any advice for how to create cohesion in a collective?
Mm. Well, this is not new, by the way. This is once the Greeks got on campus, that you started to see that fragmentation. I was on the board of the board of advisors for the Rockefeller Center. For mm-hmm. several years. They bring me up about 3-4 times a year, and I'd asked whoever was in the administration, whatever, you know, I'd like to meet with the Black students while I'm here. And so I'm staying an extra day rather than going mm-hmm. back to New York so I could meet with folks. And it's like maybe three people, sometimes it took two people to show up. And I said, what's going on? They said, well, there's a Q-Sci-Fi thing going down the street, or there's a track meet going over here. And it's like, you know, okay. I understand that, but it's not like, do you know who I am kind of thing, but you know, we would love to have somebody, you know, from another era kind of, you know, explain. So I think, you know, there's a certain insularity that takes place there, but I think, you know, what it comes down to is a, you know, what would be a common cause? Admissions is still an issue. I mean, the day, you know, Black students or an alumni for them are going to take our foot off the pedal with respect to admissions is the day that you'll see admissions go down. Mm. Okay. Needs to be more of a, you know, focus on, you know, okay. So getting somebody to move to Hanover, you know, a black person moved to Hanover with their family. It would seem like a big push for life. So what are some creative alternatives? Okay, mm-hmm. Well, for one thing, the last 2 years has taught us that you can actually teach a class via Zoom. And mm-hmm. so maybe, you know, you say to dealing with the administration, say, okay, you know, we have faculty that needs to be on campus, let's say 3 days a week, and they can be home, you know, 4 days a week, something like that. And we can do Zoom for meetings and what have you. You have to accommodate that situation because, you know, I mean, imagine, you know, you're 32, 35-year-old scholar and, you have a wife and a little kid and everybody's black, you know, and you go up to Hanover, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, where's the sister supposed to get her hair done? You know, mm-hmm. you know, do I want my kid to be the only black kid in every class they're in? I mean, I was, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't recommend that for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think the burden is on black students to put the burden on the college to say, okay, these are the facts, okay, but we're in the 21st century, for God's sake, okay, how can we adjust the circumstances so that we can attract faculty and not have them totally disrupt their lives, you know, mm-hmm. and maybe over time, you know, people will feel comfortable moving there, but there needs to be a critical mass. Who wants to be the first one? Or the second one, or third one, whatever it is now, you know, mm-hmm. it is, you know, and suppose I don't even like that person, you know, yeah, now we really messed up, you know, so I think that would be, you know, faculty and administration, because that's the heart of the college, you know, that's the mm-hmm. heart of the college. I mean, you know, when, you know, if you admissions is great, and, you know, but unless you have the administration and the faculty really kind of driving the engine, you wind up with students coming in and feeling disaffected and not really engaged and involved and all of those kinds of things. And that would be my suggestion.
Got you. And as, I guess, a final question, do you have any advice or wisdom to impart on people attending them in college?
Say it again.
Do you have any imparting wisdom or advice for students?
Parting? I'm not going anywhere. I'll be all right. You mean right now? Yes. Well, I think it's a useful question. I think number one would be to remember why you're there, which is to mm-hmm. get an education. Okay, but an education is not contained solely in those books. Okay, it's also you get educated by, you know, broadening your experience, whether it's, you know, going to speakers programs, taking courses that you don't know anything about, you know, study abroad programs or working in Jersey City or whatever it is. The purpose is, I tell my students all of the time, college is not a job training program. Okay. College is a life training program. And you don't just, you know, you don't train for your life just by going through, you know, 25 different syllabi or however many courses there are. That's not it. Okay. That's kind of a foundational aspect of it. But I think, you know, people need to remember why they're there. They're there to become a more complete person. You will not graduate as a complete person, and none of us are ever really complete, but you want to be more complete than that smart-ass high school senior that got out of there in the first place, right? And the other is that, again, it's not just about getting a job. It's just, I'm repeating myself, but if all you did you went to college was because you wanted to get a good job and make good money and be able to live in a nice house, then, you know, every sacrifice that your parents made and people that you never will know made and all those things are really, you know, being cut, you know, played cheap. All right. Because the idea is, you know, when you leave college, wherever it is, and certainly when you leave Dartmouth, is that you have some vision on how you can make this world better. I don't think that's too grandiose. I mean, you know, we will not, none of us will make the world better by ourselves, but we want to make, you know, you'd like to say at the end of your story, you made a difference. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you're not making a difference just by making money. Nobody's knocking making money, Lord knows, but that's not enough. You know, giving to charity is not enough. Okay. Giving of yourself is everything. And so I think, you know, my advice would be to, you know, right now, you know, learn as much as you can about everything that you can, you know, so that you'll be prepared to, you know, is it, you know, and it sounds kind of grandiose, but it's true, to, you know, to make this place a better place. You know, I mean, you know, again, you know, people have made too many sacrifices just so that somebody can live in a big damn house, you know, you know, God bless them if they are, but if that's all you did, you know, that's really, that would be, you know, that'd be dismaying to say the least. So, that's what I would say is that, you know, people need to focus on, you know, how, you know, and again, there's no magic trick to it. I think I, you know, for myself, you know, a lot of it was just instinctive, you know, just, you know, because once you get to college, you get taken out of this, you know.
Oh, your mic cut off a little bit.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hello? Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
I can't hear you.
Oh. Oh, I can't hear you anymore. I don't know what's going on.
Ah, can you hear me now?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, but I can't hear you. What did I do? Just a minute. Jesus. Ah, boy. This never happens. Okay, so the microphone is okay.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Okay, got you. I got you now. Can you hear me?
Awesome. Yes.
Okay. This has never happened before, Zuri. It's all your fault. That's all I got.
I'll take the blame.
But I would, you know, I kind of instinctively just, I mean, I took courses in Islamic history, for example. You know, you say, why? Because it's different. It's learned something else. I mean, I was very good in Spanish at the college, and I was doing 20-page papers in Spanish by the end of my freshman year, and I was going to spend a semester in, where the hell is it? Somewhere in Spain, and I didn't because I was committed to being more involved with the Afro-Am program. Now I look back on it and say, well, maybe you should have gone to Spain. On the other hand, I said, well, you know, I've been to Spain, you know, and it's not like I never got to Spain, you know, and I've been to a lot of other places in the world, and it seemed like the right thing to do at the time. But, you know, I would say, you know, to maximize every opportunity for learning that exists at the college, because once you get out of college, you know, the opportunities for learning start to narrow. I mean, we will always learn through our entire lives, but the opportunities to, as I said, take, you know, a course in Islamic art or something like that, or just, you know, maybe not something that they're easily able to do. But I think the whole idea, and even, you know, not going to Spain that next year, was that the reason I didn't, because I thought I could help make the college better for Black people, and in turn make it better for Black people a lot of other places as well. It's probably a little grandiose for a 17-year-old to be thinking that way, but that's the way I was thinking. You know, and so I can't knock that. I can't knock that. But it's got to be more than just, you know, self. It's got to be, you know, something else than that. And I think everybody's capable of doing that. And I, you know, and it's very rewarding. You know, it's very rewarding. You know, you may not get a medal. They may not name a dorm after you. That's okay. But if you know that you've made it, I guess more than anything else, I'd like to say that wherever I've been, I've made a difference. Okay. And, in terms of work activity and so on. You want to make a difference and it should be positive. And I don't think that's too much to ask. I certainly, our great grandparents, who I never knew, you know, but I know history and I know what they had to be dealing with. That's for sure. And as I said before I got all choked up about it, which is that, think of, and maybe that's the best thing I can say, Zuri, which is that if you could see yourself through the eyes of somebody in your family who lived in 1900, what would they think? Mm. What would they think? Would they be glad that you got a nice house and a nice car or you know, because that's when people were being hung from trees just, you know, every day, you know, and where, you know, just looking cross-eyed at somebody would get you killed and what have you. And there's so many don'ts for being black in this country, and not just in the South for sure. To see, you know, to see you or anybody, and see any of us, and see, well, did you make a difference, you know, beyond your own self? Because believe me, in 1900, we were all in the same pot, you know, that's for sure. You know, people didn't care who you were, you know, what school you went to or anything like that. On a given day, it burned the whole town down. You know, Rosewood, Tulsa, just a couple of examples, burned the whole town down, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, it was really, you know, an era of terrorism. And so what are we doing to make sure that doesn't happen again? You know, and if we don't think it doesn't happen again, it couldn't possibly happen again, then, you know, then we are fools, you know, and we have always had to be vigilant in that regard. Not that I called anybody a fool. I didn't mean to call I said, we are fools. Yes. So any event. So that's what we got. But that's all right. Yeah. What else you got there, Zori?
Well, I'd really love to ask you more.
Well, go ahead. I'm good for about another 15, 20 minutes.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left before the recording maxes out.
Okay, I'll speak faster.
Okay. I'm really curious. How did you fare? I don't know if this is getting too personal, but how did you fare back at your time at Dartmouth with no woman being on campus?
Well, that was very interesting. I think all male schools have truly skewed America mm-hmm. because the leadership of America over, you know, 200 years has been basically in large part graduates of the Ivy League schools, which are all male. Okay, that's not good. Okay, it's the reason why you have sexual harassment, you've got sexual discrimination, and it was normalized over the years because the only time men, you know, saw women was as a date, and vice versa, you know, and which is why I think, you know, same gender schools are not a good idea because, you know, any more than I think, you know, same race schools would be a good idea. You know, now the HBCU community is going to run after me, I know, but that's okay. You know, but I think that, you know, socially, you know, men get to be very creative. And so we found every woman's school within a 250-mile radius of the college for sure. You know, but that doesn't answer your question. I think it really is skewed and scarred, you know, just the, you know, I mean, you know, as respectful as, you know, men might want to be and how, you know, you can't normalize the relationship between people just on from Friday to Sunday or something like that. And again, you know, many women go to these schools looking for a husband, you know, literally looking for a husband as opposed to just a date. You know, and that may be another thing. Men are looking for a date, women are looking for a husband in some place the twain shall meet. But I think that, you know, I wish that I had gone to school in a co-ed setting, you know, in terms of socialization skills. Quite, I'll be very honest, you know, socialization skills. And most importantly, being, you know, fortunately, you know, my mother didn't take any shit from my father, and so it's like, you know, I grew up with a strong black woman as my mother and a role model, and so you know, I would say, you know, certainly in all of my if you talk to any women who were in you know, for whom I was responsible for any supervisory positions, you know, executive positions, I think I'd get pretty good grades, you know, and in terms of, you know, being able to, quite seriously, you know, just, you know, being able to work with women as equals, and, you know, promoting women and making sure, you know, I would say so, but, socially, I think it stunts you. Quite frankly, you know, it's stunted growth. It just, how can it be? How can it not be? You know, it's like, you know, you don't get to use your left hand until you get out of college. Well, okay, your left hand is not going to be as good as your right hand, that's for sure. You know, and I think I understand how it came to be in the first place, because it came from a notion of sexism that women didn't need to learn anyway, you know, but it was an antiquated notion. Even when I showed up in 1966, for goodness sake, it was an anachronism. It shouldn't have been around. And I think, you know, the reason you see more women, whether they're judges or, you know, executives and what have you, is that, you know, people, you know, there's now a whole generation of people always grew up with women in kind of co-equal positions, you know, but the old guys, you know, just, you know, still, fortunately they're aging out at this point. But it's, you know, again, and socially it definitely, it's not good. It's not good. It's not good. It was not good. You know, and I wouldn't, you know, if there was some way to do it differently, I wish I could have done it. But there really wasn't at the time. If you wanted to go to one of the Ivy League schools, they're all male. Now, there's a female school around the corner or down the street or down the road in Dartmouth's case or what have you. But, you know, the reality is you need to be in the same classroom. You know, you need to be able to, you know, hear, have robust debates between men and women that are just between two people, not because there's a female over there, male over there, and all that kind of stuff. It's just, you know, and again, I can repeat again, socially, if the only time you see a woman is, you know, have a date, that's not good. You know, it's just not good. And I think, you know, generations have been scarred by that, quite frankly.
Got you. Well, I just want to thank you for taking the time, joining me today, and like being vulnerable and having this conversation with me.
Who said they're not being vulnerable? Hey, who's vulnerable? I'm not vulnerable. I wasn't crying. No? I wasn't crying.
Not at all. Not at all. See, yeah, I wasn't either.
No, that's it's you know it I wasn't quite sure what to expect, sorry, quite frankly, and so I thought it was I thought it'd be interesting to give it a try, and if you have other questions, we can reconvene. I'm going to talk to the people who run the Hanover Partners, and if we can't get you for it'll be next Sunday, which would be whatever that the hell that is, November something. Then it'll be the second. Then it'll be in November for sure. But I think, you know, this project that you're working on is very, it's great and exciting, not just because it's, you know, old men getting to tell battle stories, but I'm hoping that there's some lessons in there. I mean, I wish I had, you know, access to this kind of, you know, information, and, you know, when I was where you are now, you know, from 30, 40 years ago, what it was like. It's, I hope that you've heard, and as you put this together, that there's so many similarities between the times. It's not that different. It's different kind of different light, but it's not that different, is it? Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, but there's strategies that are consistently useful over the ages, and the most important one of those is consistency. You know, I believe, you know, it's just to keep at it every day, keep showing up. You know, keep showing. Didn't I tell you no yesterday? Yes, and I'm back today. You know, no again. All right, I'll see you tomorrow. You know, and that's how we finally got these people to yes. There was not a lot of support when we first started talking about, you know, black faculty. What are you talking about? You know, black administrative. You know, and now it's considered the norm, right? Mm-hmm. Not as much of a norm as it should be. You know, when we get a black president, then we'll see. Now, then we'll be talking. You know, although be careful what you ask for, because it could be Tim Scott, right? You know, something like that. In which case, you know, we'd definitely, you know, say, wait. Let's try this again. <You know? laughs> So, any event. All right. Well, listen, if you have any other questions, you give me a buzz. I'm going to send you that photo as soon as I find it, which was taken the day of my graduation, which will be a different photo than what you see today, you know, for
sure.
All right. Okay. All right, Tori. Okay. I'll look forward to